Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. El Gaito, no go. No go for Gaito. Luis Gutierrez yesterday.
It's Luis Gutierrez.
Yeah. Please come and join me in drafting Chuy Garcia for mayor of the city of Chicago. We need Jesus, who has a heart big enough for all of us and whose strength of character and love of the city and its people will build a unified bridge between...
I want Chuy to come back and finish that revolution that he started 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Lo siento para...
The revolution will be televised, according to Gaito. And not a surprise. By the way, I actually posted this before his noon press conference. I knew what he was going to do.
Right, but I thought you said yesterday that he was going to back Tony Preckwinkle, Queen Sugar, Brady.
The belief was that there was a consolidation afoot behind Preckwinkle, but that was before... Chuy decided to make a go of it. And see, the great thing for Chuy is, so he wins a congressional seat in November, and then he runs for mayor in the spring, winter, spring. And so if he wins the mayoralty, then he's the mayor. If he loses, then he's the congressman. It's win-win, as it always is for the political ruling class.
And who the heck is Luis Gutierrez to think so highly of himself to call a noon press conference to make this announcement?
While I won't run for mayor, I can certainly put forward someone who should run for mayor. And someone who will give to Chicago what it desperately needs. A leader who sees all of our citizens as worthy, equal participants in this vibrant city of ours. Jesus, Chuy Garcia is a man for these times. I can't think of a single leader who has his finger on the pulse of Chicago and cares more deeply about its future.
That's the threshold test too. By the way, so here's the thing. This was just a choreographed setup to draft Chuy, to try and generate enthusiasm behind Chuy. So then Gutierrez does the "I'm not running, Chuy should run." And then they start to go, and then next week, Chuy, you'll be like, you know, the people have called me to run. And how can I and who am I to deny the people their desire for this great city of ours?
It's so embarrassing.
I think I'm a pretty convincing person. I think I'm going to be pretty adamant. And I assure you that Chuy's going to circulate petitions to put his name on the ballot, or I will.
I mean, honestly, if he doesn't do it, I will. Because he has to finish what he started 4 years ago. No, he didn't win 4 years ago for a reason. He lost to a terrible incumbent and a terrible candidate. So he's not going to win this time. And I can't stand people that now that Mayor Emanuel's out, they're going to throw their hat in the ring.
So here's the thing. The Latinos had to have a candidate.
It's Latinos. Yes, go on.
If they didn't have a candidate that would, in this time with this open seat, they would look incredibly weak politically. And that's I'm talking about, when I say Latinos, I'm talking about Latino politicos, not actual human beings. I'm just talking about the politicians. So they would look weak politically. So they had to advance somebody that was, if not credible, that has a constituency. Gutierrez is going to go fleece the federal government in Puerto Rico. He doesn't have time for this anymore.
Right.
So, and they don't like Mendoza, right? There's internal rivalries within that politico community. So this crowds out Mendoza, Susana Mendoza, the comptroller as well.
Yeah, this is nice, but I want to hear from Chewy. I mean, does he even want to run for mayor?
He's running. That's what this is. What do you mean, does he want to run?
Well, if he wants to run, suck it up. Get some cojones, some cebollas, and get up there and make that announcement yourself instead of having your little gallito friend do it for you.
Well, as I said, it's choreographed to try and get a couple of bites at the apple, so it makes some sense politically from a marketing perspective, I suppose. So it's interesting because now the word is that Madigan and most of the Latino members of the city council are ready to back Chewy upon his announcement.
Really?
The Madigan choice is an interesting one because he's making a bet not just on his district. Don't forget, Madigan's district, like Burke's district, not Southwest Side Irish anymore. Mm-hmm. Those are Latino districts. So he's protecting his district, but even more interestingly, he's making a play for the demographics of the city of the future. Oh. With the rising Latino population, particularly relative to the black population. That's what he's doing. And he probably figures that there's a way to massage the black caucus, particularly in the House caucus, by not backing Preckwinkle. There's other things they can do. Maybe there's not as much enthusiasm for Preckwinkle as people who are Preckwinkle supporters would like you to believe. So the political dynamics of it are interesting. The upshot is, I mean, it's just one more socialist in the race. That's the upshot. By the way, the great tweet, Mother Jones did this piece on Lori Lightfoot.
Yeah.
If Lori Lightfoot wins, she would be the first openly gay mayor of Chicago.
It's so tiring. Who cares anymore?
The tweet response was, when will we get the first openly competent mayor of Chicago? That seems to me the operative question, and I have no idea what the answer to that question is. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know what? I'm almost agreeing with everything you guys are saying because I don't think it matters who's in charge. The only question, I got two questions. When would the city file bankruptcy and as well as the school board, our school district, and will they have enough guts to pull the bodyguards off of Ed Burke? Thank you for my call.
Thanks for the call, Ed. I guess it all depends on who the next mayor is, if they've got the guts to pull the team of sycophants that follows Ed Burke around and sits in a Lincoln Town car waiting for him to finish lunch at the Union League
Club. Who wants
to
off that guy?
Nobody knows who he is. It's people who think everybody
like
knows
Pappas,
who they are.
Who uses a fake name to the yoga class I go to.
Nobody outside this little bubble of
who
ruling
cares?
Class hangers-on knows these people or cares about them. If you forced Ed Burke on somebody, people would be like, oh, okay.
Maybe.
City council,
his wife.
He's an alderman, well, whatever. Who cares?
This is a democracy, and we will make democracy work.
El Gallito. This is how we do it in the Hilly's 4th District. Just another Democrat unrealistic. I want to hear you scream impeach 45.
El Gallito.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Talking about the Chicago mayor's race, taking your calls 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Maybe this will become more of a pronounced issue in this campaign. It certainly should be. And in the state, for that matter. Another report from the Chicago Tribune in their Betrayed series about sexual abuse in the Chicago public schools.
Oh, no.
It's just incredible to me, the lack of attention that's being paid to this. Marvin Lovett was a trusted mentor to students at Johnson Elementary School. He was also a pedophile. He used a hidden camera in his apartment closet to make pornographic videotapes of students. According to police and school reports, he plied boys with cash and gym shoes as he destroyed their childhoods. Shot to death in April 2000 by a teenage student he abused for 5 years, since the boy was 12 years old. Lovett has been accused in lawsuits of sexually abusing at least 19 boys in their North Lawndale community. It's the largest known case of sexual abuse involving a CPS worker, reports the Tribune. One that's led to $2.7 million in legal settlements earlier this year. Yeah, no one in CPS was ever held accountable for allowing this predator to work, to volunteer and work in the West Side School. Now, the Tribune uncovered a 58-page case manager's report from the CPS Inspector General's office in which four CPS employees told investigators they had raised concerns with the school's principal, Maddie Tyson, about Lovett's interactions with boys. Tyson knew or should have known that Lovett was either an active pedophile or posed a risk to students at Johnson School, according to a 2002 investigative report. So you have a principal of a school where 19 boys were apparently sexually abused, $2.7 million in legal settlements.
Just from him alone. From this
right. And so let's talk about the Catholic Church. Let's talk about wherever this evil manifests itself. But mayoral candidates, CPS parents, people who are, whether you're Catholic or not, are just as upset and outraged about the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church as Catholics are.
I was with a group of parents last night. They don't know about this.
Well, that's
which is so
right. They don't know about this. I mean,
they weren't here when the first story broke, and I'm sure. Well, I've let them know that what's going on.
523 cases of sexual violence against students in CPS just in the last 10 years, according to the Tribune's reporting. Bruno in Naperville.
Yeah, regarding Chicago, I don't really see anything changing until the city runs out of money, until the bond lenders decide that they're not going to lend any more money to the city. Up until that point, the politicians and the constituencies are just on the gravy train, and they're just going to ride this thing for as long as they can.
Yeah, perhaps. Thanks for the call, Bruno. I mean, I understand the cynicism. I sort of am, too. You know, there's not a lot of people on that gravy train relative to the overall population. It's worth noting. A lot of people that just get bills in the mail. But they do seem to just enjoy and find very entertaining this kleptocracy that they're in. And there's fatalism, too, and those sorts of things. But I've said it before. I'll say it again. You know better and you don't demand better. You won't get better. Read this Tribune story, though. About this Johnson Elementary School case. Martin Lovett was the predator. Maddie Tyson, the principal, implicated as having guilty knowledge of what was happening, knew or should have known. And the instances from this Inspector General's report of what people at the school saw and reported.
Well, a CPS principal at a nearby school got rid of Lovett because he was volunteering, and they, you know, see that he was coming on to teenage boys, so they released him from there, and then that other school picked him up.
Sounds like a familiar dance of the lemons, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what they do in the Catholic Church.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and it's new and improved Amy. She can see now. I noticed you're wearing glasses this morning.
Yeah, my vision is failing in my older age.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Don't look at me. I'm hideous. No, I'm still. It's I'm.
No, they
nearsighted.
They're very stylish.
Well,
they look very good on you.
Is this a forced compliment, Dan? Sorry, we'll get used to him.
Boy.
Josh, don't look over here, okay?
No.
I can see better, though. Now, this is why I was a name assassinator, because I couldn't see people's names to pronounce them correctly.
Sure, and because you went to Iowa.
Next week, I'm going to have a cane.
Yeah, it's
and then a walker.
I remember Amy. Everything was fine, and then she went rapidly. It started, and the deterioration just increased in pace. No. It's very good. You look very professorial.
All right.
Yeah.
My kids were horrified. Don't wear those to pick me up at Blaine.
Well, exactly. I wouldn't go out with you in public either. This is interesting because this sort of feeds into this piece from Julie Kelly at American Greatness, amgreatness.com. And she's a local, by the way. She's at Orland Park. Media needs to stop hiring young know-nothings. They need to go to seasoned reporters who wear glasses. It's an interesting point that she makes.
That's true. No one watches local news because who are these people and they're 12 years old?
Well, and she's talking about the D.C. press corps, but she essentially, her point is, one way to clean house, and she refers to the tantrums by White House press corps members and the number of mistakes and corrections that have had to be made about coverage as it pertains to Trump from CNN and Washington Post and others. One way to clean house would be to stop populating the newsrooms and green rooms of the top media outlets in the country with young, inexperienced, and vulnerable reporters. She remembers, or she reminds us that Ben Rhodes, remember President Trump's ghostwriter, bragged how easy it was to manipulate news coverage. Quote, the average, this is Rhodes, the average reporter we talk to is 27 years old, and their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns. They literally know nothing.
Wow.
The cynical, if not accurate, view of the press corps from President Obama's, one of President Obama's top national security aides. Remember the whole echo chamber disclosure?
Yep.
Julie Kelly reminds us of Ali Watkins, the 20-something reporter collaborating with the security chief at the Senate Intelligence Committee, collaborating meaning sleeping with, to leak classified information tied to the Trump-Russia investigation. Not only was Watkins reporting the secret details under her byline, she carried on this three-year affair with a married man 30 years her senior.
I'm sure that's worked out well for everybody involved.
Well, her point is it has for Ali Watkins. Instead of being banished, she's promoted. When this all came to light about Ali Watkins, the paper's editor refused to fire her. And she continues at the New York Times. She gives another example of Natasha Bertrand over at The Atlantic, who is a 26-year-old Vassar grad covering national security and the intelligence community, who hasn't written a piece about Nikki Haley or John Bolton. She just regurgitates anti-Trump talking points. But what about that? I mean, you see that here. My experience, a lot of experience in media and press here, political campaigns and whatnot.
You run some campaigns.
The whole idea of know-nothings, the people who are covering particular areas of which they know very little, it's just sort of, that's why political campaigns are covered almost exclusively as a horse race, because that's all they care about. Who's going to win? Who's going to win? Who's going to win? Yeah. They care not about who should win. They care not about what would this person versus that person winning translate into with respect to policy, because they don't understand the underlying policies or the debate or the differences. You know, sometimes they're not so pronounced, but the nuances are important, and nuance is completely lost in press coverage. Understanding, and it's not just political campaigns, it's municipal government, it's state government. When you get to the federal level, good examples here from Julie Kelly about national security related coverage, sort of an important topic area. But the idea of, and the same thing, by the way, to improve the level of discourse, the intelligence of it on the cable news networks across the board. We've talked about this before. On the conservative side, quote unquote conservative side, the likes of Tommy Lahren.
Yeah, what are her political chops or what's her scoop?
She, you know, had a couple of good rants, and she's a good-looking young blonde. That's what her bona fides are, as far as
easy
I can tell.
Easy on the eyes. Maybe she needs a pair of glasses.
Exactly. Make her look a bit more seasoned. There's no question. But you were a reporter 100 years ago.
Oh, my
God. What's your experience?
So rude. Well, they always like to hire young, and because when you hire young, they're cheaper. Because you don't have to pay them as much as you have to pay somebody who's seasoned, who's been experienced, who's spent time in other markets.
Well, and on
so you go to smaller markets and then you work your way up. But sometimes rules are different for different people.
But on TV, I can understand. Look, you want somebody that's telegenic on TV, and there's nothing wrong with that. I get it. But when it comes to the larger press corps, it seems to me you don't need somebody telegenic with a byline in a newspaper.
Right.
Or on the radio, which is right. Obviously why I'm on the radio. But I get the X factor with respect to TV. But even still, there are, you know, telegenic people who can actually string a sentence together, who actually have
know the history of the office of the presidency, know the history of the State Department, know the history of Chicago politics, and that gets lost. I mean, I'll never forget working with a person, I'm not going to say their name, who had no idea how many U.S. senators from Illinois there were. And I said, well, it's the same in every state, regardless of population. Congressional districts and congressmen and women are dependent on how many people live in your state. Senators, there's two from every state. No clue.
And
no clue in the world about that.
And we know that woman today is Don Lemon. Is that right?
It's not Don Lemon.
Well,
that's
a good example. I mean, look, I've talked to a lot of reporters in this city about Illinois and Chicago politics. And there are some that are very knowledgeable and they're dutiful and they work hard and they get it. They talk to a lot of people. They do their job. And so if what they don't know, they learn, and they learn quickly. And there are others that are clueless. And also, and by the way, age is not the only issue here. There are others, too, who've been around forever who are awful and have been awful forever and have been transactional forever and have been drunk forever. But enough about Rick Pearson.
Oh, hey, oh.
Tom in Deer Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning, Dan and Amy. And I agree with your premise. And it's something that we've tried to impress upon our kids is if you want to learn something, keep your television set off. If you think that you're a liberal, but you watch CNN and CNBC, or if you consider yourself a conservative or you're from the right and you watch Fox, at the end of the day, you don't know anything. So there's so many good magazines out there, including the ones that this author mentioned. They are good magazines if you just dig in deep enough. And we try to put our kids who are ages that aren't inclined to read that. But, Dan, you have many of the writers for these magazines on your show. And to me, that's what we got to push. Because I have adults my age, and it's hard to have a conversation with them because they've been inured to their echo chamber, whether it's their radio host or their TV host.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call, Tom. One other thing I'd say, and this goes for the reporters as well. I mean, it's like you were saying, just even basic stuff, the Schoolhouse Rock stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But in addition to that, here's a thought. Read some books. Read some, get some foundational knowledge and then also be a voracious consumer of content across the board in a particular topic area on a daily basis. But there's a bunch of politicians running around, too, who are, asleep from the neck up.
Right.
I mean, they don't know anything either. And they parrot talking points from their side, from whichever side you're coming from. But you can always tell somebody who's read the books from somebody else who's just pantomiming some of the takeaways from the books. And I'm talking about foundational economics books, foundational political philosophy books, foundational history books. It makes a big difference because it gets you asking the right questions and it gives you historical perspective so that today isn't the first day of Western civilization every day.
Right.
So you have institutional knowledge that you routinely see completely absent. Well, you see absent. That is routinely absent when it comes to press coverage at every level. Marty in Naperville.
Hey, good show. Two things. First of all, there was a reporter that came to Chicago one time. She just started. She was young, probably 10 years ago. She's still here. And she was doing the traffic, and she kept calling the Eisenhower Expressway. And she just kept doing it. I wanted to throw something at the TV. But the Eisenhower Expressway? So that's what you get. So,
yeah.
And another thing, Dan,
what
if the pet peeves where they have things where you say stuff and you don't like them is sleeping with? I wish people would stop using the term sleeping with when there's some kind of a sexual affair going. Nobody's sleeping.
What would you prefer, making whoopee?
Whatever.
Would you prefer?
Anything but sleeping with. Maybe that's why these relationships end, because the people are sleeping together.
Yeah, they don't really sleep together. You're right.
Yeah.
I had a reporter once who called Decatur Decatur, and that was reporting live from Decatur. Excuse me, it's Decatur. And then Bourbonnais, somebody called it Bourbonus.
Bourbonus. Yeah. Now
she joins us in live from Bourbonus.
Yeah, no, oh. I can understand. You,
that's
but
all right.
This is also just, you know, being detail oriented.
Right, I'm just.
I mean, if you're not from Illinois, you may not know that Cairo here is pronounced Cairo.
Cairo.
I mean, right. Cairo here is pronounced Cairo. I got to reverse.
No, you're.
Cairo is Egypt. Cairo Illinois,
Illinois.
Right? Or Marseille is pronounced Marcellus with respect to the town here.
Then here you go, Madison.
Yeah.
Right? Or do you call it Madison? Matson or Madison?
Matson.
But if you call the police department, they pick up and say Madison.
Hmm.
That's a big one. Alsip or Alsip?
Alsip.
Alsip. Remember, we all want to sip. That's what somebody told me.
No, it's so great.
That's fantastic.
It's a great memory device.
Oh, I want to take a sip.
Eisenhower, huh?
The Eisenhower.
I haven't heard that one before. And I mean, somebody, hey, you know, I think he said it was a woman. Young lady, Eisenhower, do you know what that expressway? Do you know who that expressway is named after?
Dwight.
Why don't you look it up? Look it up and introduce yourself to American history, to past presidents.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. AM 560. The Answer.
All right. We're playing the name game in Illinois here, or the pronunciation game. Bill in the North Suburbs.
Hey, good morning. You've got a couple of your newsmen that pronounce Illinois, Illinois. I'm wondering if that's one of the 57 states Obama used to talk about.
For now it is. Thanks for
Illinois,
the call, Bill.
Okay.
Mike Scott doesn't pronounce it that way.
No.
I don't know what Bill's talking about. It's outrageous. Mike Scott is
apoplectic
right now.
I'm from Michigan. I'll pronounce it any way I want to.
There you go.
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
He's not going to be told what to do.
Yeah.
They're defiant, nonconformists from Michigan. All right, what do we got? Chuck.
Chuck and Delavan.
Chuck. Hey, Chuck from Delavan. Hey, my grandfather was born in 1889 in Crown Point. His cousin lived down on the river in Moments. They knew the Bourbonus family pre-1900. They pronounced it Bourbonus. They were trappers on the Kankakee River, and they were also farmers. And they said Bourbonus.
That is true.
I actually
believe
you because you sound folks.
If you need any more information, even though I live in Wisconsin, if you need any more information on Illinois, call me.
Illinois.
If you got any questions about Wilmington and Yellowhammers or anything like that,
Greenwood.
Give me a call.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, thanks so much, Chuck. Now,
we'll meet you at the Jewels.
Today, it is pronounced Bourbonnais. So it may have been Bourbonus, the fur trappers in the 1800s, but it's Bourbonnais today. So let's just stick with that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The impact of the social media giants on the election, Google specifically. We talked about it a bit yesterday. Google refusing to participate in the congressional hearing last week that involved Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook and Jack Dorsey from Twitter. Google will not be held to account by members of Congress or anybody else. And so this video that surfaced yesterday via Breitbart.
Oh, good.
Of a post 2016 conference where all the Google brass was assembled. You had your Sergey Brin, you had your Larry Page, you had your Kent Walker, VP of Global Affairs, CFO Ruth Porat, VP of Operations Eileen Naughton, all there to address the Googleists, the Googlers, and try to cope with the shocking election of a President Trump that virtually all of them opposed, except James Damore, who then was fired. Right? Mm-hmm. It is a revealing look at the mentality at Google, which may not surprise you, but evidence is always helpful. And so when the concerns are raised about how Google, with its market power and effectively power of persuasion based on the sort of content it drives towards people, their ability to impact elections, it's a legitimate issue. It's an issue that Mark Stein and was talking about with Tucker Carlson the other night on his show, and Stein put it as only he can.
Well, we should be deeply concerned. As you said, Russia, everyone goes bananas about because they bought 100 grand's worth of Facebook ads or whatever it was. Google is already more powerful in terms of its control over people's lives than almost every government on the planet. And I would say arguably right. It has more control over American lives than, say, the government of Russia does as a practical matter. And people are very naive about Google searches. They think that it doesn't whether you're in a hotel in Des Moines or whether you're hanging upside down in your bondage dungeon in Poughkeepsie, when you enter the search results, everything's the same. As this lady, Eliana Murillo, has explained, they're actually capable of now targeting election content specifically to certain voting groups. So this isn't like, you know, rock the vote or public attempts to get out the vote. This is where the world's most powerful company is using data mining to channel partisan election information to key voting demographics. That's very disturbing because they'd steal the election and you'd never know it.
And this is the backdrop of this, remember, is this email that was unearthed by Fox from a Google employee who talked about efforts to turn out the Latino vote in the 2016 election. And how surprised they were at the percentage of the Latino vote that Trump got, just about 30%. So now take yourself back to 2016. In the days just following that election, Google gets together because they have to cope and have a good group cry. Sergey Brin, billionaire number one, co-founder of Google, kicks it off.
Okay, folks, I know this is probably not the most joyous TGIF we have had. You know, let's face it, most people here are pretty upset and pretty sad for because of the election. But there's another group, a small group that we should also think about who are very excited about the legalization of pot.
It's Hawaiian Shirt Friday, everybody.
He does have a little bit of Lumberg in him.
Yeah,
and,
he does.
And there's more.
Yeah, you're going to have to work Saturday.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right. Let's give a round of applause. It's okay. John's birthday.
Hey, oh,
we got
this
some birthday cake here. Take, cut a piece, pass it.
Oh, and remember, next Friday is Hawaiian Shirt Day. So, you know, if you want to, go ahead and wear a Hawaiian shirt and jeans.
Wait till if you see the video, and it's a little over an hour long.
Okay.
I watched it so you don't have to.
Is he wearing a Hawaiian shirt?
He is not, no. They are wearing T-shirts because they're too cool for school.
Oh, that's right.
They're totally relaxed.
They're hipsters.
Stripped down. Here's the thing. Wait till you go, just fast forward to the end to get the questions from the audience, the Googlers. I mean.
Wait, do you have some? Did you blog some?
Yeah, we'll get to them, but. To say they're caricatures of themselves doesn't really do it justice. Brin went on about how offensive the election result is to him and, by extension, everybody else at Google, just about. Two reasons the election is very offensive. The election results, meaning Trump's victory, very offensive.
Serious note, you know, myself, as an immigrant and a refugee, I certainly find this election deeply offensive and I know many of you do, too. And I think it's a very stressful time, and it conflicts with many of our values. I think it's a good time to reflect on that, and you know, we're gonna hopefully share some thoughts today. I guess, you know, there are two dominant you know, reasons to be upset. One is because, you know, so many people apparently don't share many of the values that we have. I mean, I guess we've known that for many months now. I mean, it's not like, you know, in election terms, whether it was like 47.2% or 48.2% or whatever it was, it's always been a lot of people that apparently feel that way. But, you know, certainly confronting it firsthand is pretty upsetting. And secondly, confronting the reality of an administration that's now forming, and look, we have no idea what it's going to do, is the honest truth. Like, we have no idea what direction this country will take.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Have you switched to DuckDuckGo yet? Maybe you ought to, and get your friends to do so, because Google is giving you, the leadership of Google is giving you great insight into the attitude of Google. And I mean, to say they were none too happy about the election result doesn't really capture it. They were broken by the election result. Sundar Pichai, who is the CEO, another billionaire.
Yeah.
Listen to him. So he follows Brin, I should say. He breaks up.
Seriously?
The CEO, a billionaire CEO of the most powerful company on the planet, can't handle an election result that was a surprise.
There is a lot of fear within Google, and I've gotten a lot of emails, you know, to my note back, you know, and, you know, I would tell most Googlers there are people who are very afraid. And, you know, Sergey pointed out, you know, many groups, you know, women, blacks, you know, people who are afraid based on religion, people who are afraid because they are not sure of their status, the LGBTQ community, and I can go on. There is a lot of fear, and so I think it's important to reach out, be aware of that fear. I would be sensitive and try and talk and have conversations to the extent possible. We are so deeply committed to our values. You know, Sergey mentioned at the start, nothing will change. I think we'll stand up always for the values we believe in, and especially I think in a society, you stand up for people who are minorities. And that's what defines a society, and we'll continue to do that.
Yeah, that's where he starts to break up and he turns off of the mic. I love how they talk about their values. They talk about it just like Rahm talked about Chicago values as an abstraction. They talk about values without ever defining them. It's fascinating. They are literally, well, not literally, but they're ripped from Silicon Valley.
Oh yeah,
the spoof on all of these people that Mike Judge created for HBO. Where he turned "Make the World a Better Place" into a punchline, because that's what they say. They're like the kind of virtue signaling politicians. They may be brilliant. They obviously are. They created this incredible company. And they're all smarter than me, at least when it comes to tech. Fine, whatever. When it comes to the quality of their communication, the quality of their thinking outside of algorithms and data collection, it's remarkable to me how simplistic and pathetic.
Can you imagine if you're a Republican working there?
Yeah.
How you'd have to hide it and not tell a soul if you wanted to keep your job?
Please see the James Damore memo and termination. There you go. That's exactly it. Now you're getting a sense of what he was talking about in no uncertain terms. It wasn't just a, so you heard from Pichai. How about the CFO, Ruth Porat? Listen to her reacting.
As we started to see the direction of the voting, I reached out to someone close to me who was at the Javits Center where the big celebration was supposed to occur in New York City.
Was.
Somebody who'd been working on the campaign. And I just sent him a note and said, you know, are you okay? It looks like it's going the wrong way. And I got back a very sad, short text that read, people are leaving, staff is crying, we're going to lose. That was the first moment I really felt like we were going to lose. And it was this massive, like, kick in the gut that we were going to lose. And it was really painful.
So just
it reminds me of that Saturday Night Live skit when they, you know, through the night, how they realized that Trump was going to win. And they started crying.
Yeah.
And then they're in shock. And then, yeah.
But there's an important difference between the wailing of some Antifa goon and the power structure of the world's most powerful company speaking like you're hearing them speak with the influence at their disposal. I mean, it's something to address. Again, I'm not talking about government intervention and how Google operates its business, but I'm also not talking about walking through life with blinders on. Understand who these people are, how they think, and what they intend to do in furtherance of their thinking, because they intend to do something. And Pinchai gets to that later in the video. Let's take a couple calls. Bruce in Bloomingdale, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Thank you for this steaming hot cup of Schadenfreude, guys. I'm really enjoying it. You know, two quick points. One, we as a society seem to make the mistake that because somebody's good at one thing or smart at one thing, they're smart at everything.
Right.
My second point is these people hate us. They intend to cut us out of politics and lead us around like cows. So we better wake up and pay attention because they mean it. They're saying it right to our faces, and we need to take them at their word.
They absolutely are. Thanks for the call, Bruce. Jordan in Forest Park.
Yes, good morning. You know, I'm kind of amazed that there's so much attention to this because I would bet you could find videotape from ABC, CBS, CNN, where it was a lot worse than what Google was saying about how the world's going to end. But you know what? This is their sandbox. You know they own it. They can do whatever they want. I'm amazed that they're not owning up to it. Hey, yeah, we are a liberal organization. We adapt our searches and be proud of it. Why are they hiding it?
Even go to D.C. when they could have.
Well,
with Facebook and Twitter. I mean, they're really hiding it.
The spokesman from Google, in response to the leaking of this video, for over 20 years, everyone at Google has been able to freely express their opinions at these meetings. Nothing was said at the meeting or any other meeting to suggest that any political bias ever influences the way we build or operate. Maybe not build, but operate our products.
That's a bold-faced lie.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Listen to this exchange between Pinchai, the CEO, and a Google employee who asks a question about exactly that, about making sure we get information to people so they can make decisions that are best for them. Implicit is as we define it.
Is Google willing to really invest in grassroots, super hyper-local efforts to bring tools and services and understanding of Google products and knowledge to all these communities far flung around the U.S. and the world so people can really be informed citizens and make the decisions that are really best for themselves and their countrymen?
And the response?
But even in that, we're going to take a look to make sure our educational programs, which we do, are also reaching geographical places, segments of the population where it's probably not fully reaching. So those are all things we are going to look at, and I'm absolutely confident we can do more as we go into 2017.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do more. Now, remember the memo, the email that was being batted around by Tucker Carlson and Mark Stein about trying to increase the turnout, the Latino voter turnout. Mm-hmm. Do more. This statement from a Google employee that received rousing applause from the entire power structure that was on stage, as well as, and you can hear it, all those Googleists in attendance. You ready for this?
Speaking to white men, there is an opportunity for you right now to understand your privilege in the society.
take the opportunity to go through the bias-busting training, read about privilege, read about the real history of oppression in our country, and tomorrow night, watch 13th, the movie that is here. If you can't watch it here, watch it on Netflix. Discuss the issues you are passionate about during Thanksgiving dinner, and don't back down and laugh it off when you hear the voice of oppression speak through metaphors, and I promise to do this.
Wow. Seriously, you tell me how that's any different than the college campus stories that we have availed you to. Myriad stories of this sort about intolerance, restriction of free expression, unwillingness to engage alternative viewpoints, a proactive desire to suppress opposing viewpoints. And that's the attitude of everyone who was clapping. And that includes Brin and Page and Pinchai and the rest of the power structure. It's something to take under advisement at minimum, Don in Bloomingdale.
Guys, this is the moment that you realize, or these people realize, that not everyone in the world thinks like them. And their grasp for reality is very troubling. And I, you know, Dan, you talk about it all the time. This is the result of demasculating men in our public schools. I mean, listen to these people. Could these guys change a tire on a side of a highway? No, they'd be lost.
Thanks for the call, Don. Wait till we get to Larry Page.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And so, as predicted on this show, he gone, Jeff Fager, 60 Minutes chief. He has been bounced from CBS. Now, it's interesting.
Oh, yeah. What happened? Well, they call it the Fager arm. Have you ever heard of that?
The
Fager arm.
Oh, the Fager arm. Yeah, Jeff Fager.
The Fager arm. So if you'd be at, a party or, a gathering after work, he'd put his hand on the buttocks.
Mm-hmm.
There was one intern who said, that they were with a group of coworkers and that he had groped her at that party. And she said, all of a sudden I felt a hand on my blank. The hand belonged to an arm, which belonged to Jeff Fager. Another producer told her it was...
Can't put your hand on the blank.
They referred to it, all the women called it the Fager arm, which several said they were mindful to avoid at parties. She said she was shocked. His hand could not be anywhere near her blank, but it was.
What is this blank stuff?
Well, they say the bad word you can't say on the radio, right?
Was this electric company? Yeah. Take it easy over there, George Carlin.
She said the contact was more like a stroke, and it wasn't just a, hey, what's up? It was a power trip that he had when he grabbed her buttocks. Welcome to 60 Minutes, he said. You're now one of us.
The 36 years, Fager was at CBS News, leading figure in the news division for decades. But it's interesting because the Ronan Farrow reporting on Moonves and then the revisiting of the allegations against Fager, Fager wasn't removed because of Farrow's reporting, but a violation of corporate policy with respect to treating underlings. And I don't mean of a sexual nature. Fager's statement. The company's decision had nothing to do with the false allegations printed in the New Yorker, Ronan Farrow's reporting of his alleged sexual harassment. Instead, they terminated my contract early because I sent a text message to one of our own CBS reporters demanding that she be fair in covering the story. My language was harsh, and despite the fact that journalists receive harsh demands for fairness all the time, CBS didn't like it. One such note should not result in termination after 36 years, but it did. That was Fager's statement, denying the allegations of sexual harassment and suggesting, well, he's not suggesting, but I'll suggest it, CBS used this harshly worded text message that was of a professional nature in terms of work product, as a cover to get rid of him because they wanted to get rid of him over the sexual harassment allegations.
Ah, I see how they did it. Because they had a reporter in CBS who's doing a story about sexual harassment about Moonves, and they asked him for a comment. And he said, you have to be fair and center this really just abrasive text message.
Right.
So that's how they got him. Hmm. What kind of severance package is he going to have? Because Moonves is $120 million.
You can't say package on the air.
Oh. Package.
Now, what about this? So just in this whole Me Too storyline, Norm MacDonald.
Yeah, what's going on there?
Norm MacDonald.
He was supposed to be on Fallon. I was watching. He never showed up.
Norm MacDonald's hilarious to me. But if you haven't seen Hitler's Dog, his latest comedy special, maybe a year old. It's on Netflix. Pretty good stuff. On Tuesday this week, Fallon announced he would no longer host Norm MacDonald. Quote, out of sensitivity to our audience and in light of MacDonald's comments in the press today. So what did Norm MacDonald say?
He defend Roseanne or?
Well, he talked about the Me Too movement generally. Here's what MacDonald said. It used to be 100 women can't be lying. And then it became one woman can't lie. And that became I believe all women. And then you're like, what? Like that Chris Hardwick guy, I think I really thought got the blunt end of the stick there. Then he talked about Louis C.K. and Roseanne Barr. Louis and Roseanne are two people I know, and Roseanne was so broken up after the show was canceled that I got Louis to call her, even though Roseanne was very hard on Louis before that. But she was just so broken and just crying constantly. There are very few people that have gone through what they have, losing everything in a day. Of course, people will go, what about the victims? But you know what? The victims didn't have to go through that.
Is that insensitive? 312-642-5600 is our Turnkey Debt Pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. So because of that comment, he was not on the Tonight Show.
He's canceled by Fallon. I mean, this is sort of, I mean, what MacDonald is describing was happening to him as he was describing what was happening to others, essentially. He then apologized.
Why?
On Twitter, if people interpreted his statement in such, you know, it took offense to a statement, I suppose. He writes, Roseanne and Louis have both been good friends of mine for many years. They both made terrible mistakes, and I would never defend their actions. If my words sounded like I was minimizing the pain that their victims feel to this day, I'm deeply sorry.
Well, Roseanne doesn't really have victims, but Louis K does, right?
Right. That distinction is important. Louis C.K., you know, behaved in a ghastly manner to women, physically in their presence. Roseanne tweeted out an intemperate, idiotic comment about Valerie Jarrett, a public figure.
Big difference.
I mean, but listen to what Fallon said, according to MacDonald. This is the kicker. And this goes to the Google conversation we were having about these fragile humans. Jimmy came back in.
Jimmy.
Can I talk to you, buddy? And he said he was very broken up about it. He didn't want to do this. He said, I don't know what to do. I said, you think I shouldn't do the show? Jimmy Fallon, people are crying.
Are crying?
Norm MacDonald said, people are crying? Fallon, yeah. He said, senior producers are crying. I said, good Lord, bring them in and let me talk to them. I didn't even know I had the capacity to make people cry. So I felt so bad from that comment. Fallon said, come back whenever you want, but I think it will hurt the show tonight. I said, Jimmy, I don't want to hurt your show. That's the last thing I want to do is hurt your show. People were crying over the comments I just read to you that Norm MacDonald made.
I mean, honestly, people need to get a hold of themselves.
Senior producers at this, you know, multi-cajillion dollar show on NBC, Jimmy Fallon's show, are crying because Norm MacDonald defended his friends and suggested that this idea that you believe anything a woman says, regardless of corroboration, conflicting evidence, if that's where the Me Too movement is going, then that's a little concerning. That leads senior producers at the Jimmy Fallon show to descend into a puddle of tears. Mike, on the north side. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, kids. Thanks for taking my call. Now, Dan, you got to do something about this. Maybe you can bring back, have a segment every day about liberals getting their feelings hurt and crying, and you could play that song, "We've Got Friends in Low Spaces." But in the meantime, I think maybe you should announce that you're going to be downtown on a corner. You're going to be handing out little cups of hot cocoa to the liberals and giving them a hug. Get a hug from Dan Prof. That'll make your day feel better. That's just what all the liberal dollies want, snowflakes.
I do have a lot of love to give, Mike. Thanks for pointing that out. Appreciate
it. Nothing that he said was offensive or it wasn't. He was just reliving the facts of the case, not taking sides.
Not
passing judgment on anybody.
You can take issue with the part McDonald said where he talked about very few people have gone through what they have, losing everything in a day. Of course, people go, what about the victims? But you know what? The victims didn't have to go through that. Well, I would say, I would, you know, you could push back and Norm McDonald say, well, the victims, I should say Roseanne and Louis brought this upon themselves with their improper rhetoric and or conduct. So they brought them on themselves. So, I mean, my sympathy extends only so far. Is the punishment proportional to the offense? Well, that you can argue. But, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, the victims didn't have to go through that. Well, the victims didn't have to go through anything if Roseanne and Louis would have behaved properly, right?
Right.
So, but there is a proportionality issue. And then there's just a reaction to, you know, a comedian sort of rallying to the defense of his friends and providing a perspective, raising a legitimate question about the slippery slope of the Me Too movement. And see, you can't come on the Jimmy Fallon show. Senior producers are crying. You've got billionaire.
They're crying because they had a segment to fill.
Billionaire C-suite officers of the world's most powerful company who can't get through a post-election conversation with their employees because they're so devastated by the election. I mean, it's two things. It's one, how completely lacking in resilience people are.
Everyone crawls up into the fetal position.
It's really looking to be offended because that somehow is unifying. That somehow communicates you're a good person. That's a big part of it as well. This crying and this sentimentality and this melodrama is sort of a form of passive aggressive virtue signaling. That's another aspect to it. And the last piece of this is politics. Politics has to seep into every corner of my life and my being. There is nothing that can be said or done that I won't force feed through a political prism. And that is a dismal way to live life, which is why these leftists are dismal people. John in Portage Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan, Amy. I just wanted to say that I showed, I'm sure you know what PragerU is. I showed a self-declared socialist video on PragerU, 5 minutes long. I said, now please just look at this for 5 minutes and don't say anything. Just watch it. And he started to cry.
He started to, what was the video? Which video was it? Like tax cuts?
No, don't cut my
taxes.
It was the three kids, three brothers. They all own the same house on the same block, and how socialism would destroy that. One brother was very frugal. The other brother was kind of middle, and the other brother was just a slacker.
Yeah, okay, it's possibly biblical. Okay, so was he crying for the socialists or the brothers?
No, it was about socialism.
Yeah,
it was about how socialism protects the slacker and. And he got it. He said, you know, he started to cry, and he said, "That's right." So I think I did a good thing.
All right, thanks for the call, John. Convert one starfish at a time. Good for you, John.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about Norm Macdonald getting bounced from Fallon. Jeff Fager getting bounced from 60 Minutes.
Time's up.
David in San Francisco, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, it's I'm really surprised you're sneering at these women that have been raped.
I'm not doing that.
Sure you are. You're saying that
there's snowflakes
for crying?
No, I actually didn't say that at all. And this is you're a great example, David, of somebody that doesn't listen and is unable to distinguish between, say, the case of Jeff Fager or Les Moonves or Harvey Weinstein and the case of Norm Macdonald, because you're not interested in listening. Got it. Thanks for the call, David.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Haven't seen this kind of choreography since West Side Story. El Gaito playing the role of Rita Moreno in setting up his buddy Chuy Garcia, who he conferred a congressional seat, and now he wants to help him achieve the mayoralty. Gaito is not running, but
you'll know who he wants. He wants Chuy Garcia to come back and finish what he started.
I want Chuy to come back and finish that revolution that he started 4 years ago.
Ready to join the Chuy Revolution? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text. I know you remember.
Yes.
4 years ago, 2015 election.
The runoff.
The runoff, yeah. Supported Chuy. I made the argument time and again, to no avail to so many center-right voters, that, yeah, I get that you don't think Chuy clears the credibility threshold that he could run the city. Guess what? The guy who you think can't either or won't, because it's a political courage question, not an IQ or financial literacy question. And so the first order of business is to hold the incumbent accountable for what has happened. And we chose not to do that. No. So 4 years later, we finally happened that so messed up as the city across every quality of life indice that Tiny Dancer can't even run again. If you would have listened to my advice in 2015, we'd be in a better position. And we would have had a weaker mayor that could have provided more system, provide the avenue for more system change in 2019. Now, actually, I suppose there is still that possibility with a crowded field that will include Chuy. So the Latino identity politics voters will have a Latino to vote for. And that, frankly, helps somebody like a Paul Vallis to keep this erased to 20%, 25% to make the runoff.
Well, anyone who voted for Chuy, like yourself, it was an anti-Rahm vote.
Of course.
So, and he still couldn't beat Rahm Emanuel. But this time it's going to be different. I mean, Luis Gutierrez, my God, he thinks so highly of himself. Stops everything. He's having a press conference. That's what he did yesterday. To make this grandioso announcement.
While I won't run for mayor, I can certainly put forward someone who should run for mayor. And someone who will give to Chicago what it desperately needs.
And a socialist.
A leader who sees all of our citizens as worthy, equal participants in this vibrant city of ours.
Yeah, kleptocracy.
Jesus,
yeah.
Chuy Garcia is a man for these times. I can't think of a single leader who has his finger on the pulse of Chicago and cares more deeply about its future.
People. I mean, right, doesn't Chuy Garcia, he's our Cook County Commissioner. So now he got the nod to be the next congressman that was, you know, his handpicked by Luis Gutierrez, given to him by Luis. Now he wants to be mayor? He already has a job, and he's got a backup job if that job doesn't work
well,
out.
It's
but
always,
now he wants to be mayor?
It's always win-win for the political ruling class. I'm just sorry that socialists of the Chicago can't unite on this. So that's interesting to watch. Kristen McCrory had a good tweet on the topic as well. The use of offices as heirlooms or chits in this kleptocracy. So Gutierrez anointed Chuy for his congressional seat.
Right.
And Munoz for Chuy's county board seat. Now Munoz is out. Gutierrez anoints Chuy for mayor.
Oh my gosh.
Chuy's aide for county board and the daughter and his daughter for alderman. When will voters rebel against oligarchy? Yeah, we don't like Russian oligarchs, including the autocratic oligarch in charge, interfering with our democracy. What about when we beat them to the punch? What about when we embrace oligarchy, Russian style, in Chicago? Does that concern anybody? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And there's something great about the oligarchy and the kleptocracy that the oligarchs run in this city and state. It transcends race. It transcends gender.
Yep.
So you can't play the race card. You can't play the gender card. You got to address the substance. It's the great another tweet from somebody responding to a Mother Jones article. Lori Lightfoot could, if elected, would be the first openly gay mayor of Chicago. The tweet in response, when will Chicago get its first openly competent mayor? And that's a great question, but there's a predicate question. When will Chicago voters be interested in having a first openly competent mayor rather than openly this or that? The balkanized identity politics. We're the most racially segregated town in the country, lamented by the left and conservatives like me, but lamented by the left, racially segregated. And then how do we run our elections? The blacks have to have a candidate and the Latinos have to have a candidate. And I mean have a black candidate, have a Latino candidate. And the 19th Ward has to have some Irish guy. And I mean, what? I'm so upset we're the most racially segregated city in the country that what I'm going to do is play racial politics, divisive racial politics, where every cohort has to stay in their lane and have somebody that looks like them in order for consideration of support. How stupid is that? How ignorant is that? It's the height of ignorance. And this place is the epicenter of it. So it's just fascinating to watch. Now, Gallito.
Did you say El Gallito?
This is a democracy and we will make democracy work.
El Gallito.
This is how we do it in the Hillies 4th District.
Just another Democrat unrealistic.
I want to hear you scream impeach 45.
El Gallito.
Now, by the way, real quick. No, I don't mean to get catty before you, pontificate. But El Gallito yesterday, that never wear what he was wearing. He had his shirt open. You could see his chest. It was disgusting. Just button it up. Maybe put on a tie. I don't know.
I like the look.
Oh, you like the Miami Vice?
Yeah.
Look.
Yeah. I think he can really pull it off.
So gross. I couldn't stop staring at his chest.
Now, I assume El Gallito is going down to Puerto Rico. He can't run from here. He's going down to Puerto Rico to find out why almost a million boxes of water were never delivered to the villages. You see that?
Yeah.
The photo showing the boxes, the bottles and boxes covered in a blue tarp on a runway in Cieba.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the understanding was that FEMA brought the bottles inland in 2017 in the wake of the hurricanes, and they were turned over to the central government there. So why didn't the central government distribute them? Is that Trump's fault, too? Maybe Gutierrez will get to the bottom. I'm sure he will. Michael in Andersonville.
Hi, good morning, everybody. So yesterday I was at work. I worked part-time at a really wonderful restaurant in Andersonville, and we had people coming in and out of the restaurant having our customers sign, or wanting them to sign petitions for Miss Lori Lightfoot. And the problem that I had with it is that they are actually going around and calling her the trifecta messiah of Chicago. These people who are having them sign these petitions. First of all, it's a complete violation of privacy when you're trying to eat. Nobody needs to do that, no matter what party you're from. And I just find it extremely funny that they are, first of all, playing identity politics, even though we are a minority of a neighborhood where they do focus on being gay and transgender. It's just that's the movement within the area. And the one guy came in and he was talking to me. He's like, would you like to sign this? I says, no, she's not my candidate. He literally flipped his lid. He started screaming. He goes, why wouldn't you support this? You're a gay man. I says, no. I said, yes, I am a gay man, but I am a conservative. I said, I voted for Trump. He lost his mind. And I said, really? Awesome. You came in here with a valise? I mean, I'd sign it. But don't play identity politics with all of us. There's a silent majority within the neighborhood. Not all of us support their movement. And you'd be surprised how many people in the gay community are stark conservative and believe in family value, regardless of what we decide to do in our bedroom.
Yeah, thanks and for spread the call,
the word,
Michael.
Spread the word about Paul Vallis. I appreciate that.
I'd be pleasantly surprised, I'm sure. It's good to get calls like that. I mean, right, so she's the trifecta messiah because she's black, she's gay, and she's a woman.
I mean, nothing makes me more sick than that. I mean, that's fine. She could black, gay, woman, that's fine, but using it as identity politics, aren't we over that by now? Don't we want somebody who's fiscally responsible to be in charge of our city, who could make deals with businessmen, who know how to run CPS, who knows what to happen if, you know, who's worked with FEMA if a natural disaster ever happened in Chicago? That's what I want.
Also, isn't that a sort of a cheap way to define Lori Lightfoot? I mean, she's actually...
Give me more than that. I want more about Lori Lightfoot.
Well, the point is, it's not about her specifically, although this is a good example. She's a very successful corporate attorney.
Okay, then let's talk about that.
Well, yeah, but you can't because you have to put everybody into their pen.
Right, everyone's got to be in their lane, as you said. Yeah,
and then, you know, so it's you're either part of some marginalized community, real or demagogued into marginality, perceived marginality, self-imposed marginality. Or then you get into the intersectionality, and that's the trifecta messiah pablum that Michael was telling us about. I mean, you know, so that's the kind of city you want. That's the kind of state you want. Okay. All right. It's fine.
There's still hope.
Well, I mean, I think Chewy's entrance in the race helps Vallis and other candidates because now you've got the public sector unions and their rank and file who've supported both Chewy and Preckwinkle before. Now they're going to be at a bit of cross purposes or divided up, perhaps. And so it keeps Preckwinkle, kind of right there with the rest of the field. And it starts to carve up the constituencies both she and Chewy would like to have. So, you know, you certainly have the prospect of, I don't know, a Chewy versus Vallis in a runoff or a Preckwinkle versus Vallis in a runoff. And those are probably pretty good matchups for Vallis. Although this report out of CPS, this report on this principal in CPS who allowed a predator to be in this school who allegedly sexually molesting 19 children, you know, what Vallis did or didn't do as the head of CPS during the time he was there, that's going to be revisited during this campaign, in the wake of the reporting by the Tribune. You can bet on that. Robert in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you remember the movie Paul, that nice little creature from another planet, why don't we write him and elect somebody from another planet to come down and clean up the mess down here?
Okay, the Martian Messiah. Got it. Thanks for the call, Robert.
Exactly.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy were talking about the mayor's race with El Gaito leveling up Chewy Garcia.
Who already has a job as Cook County Commissioner.
To be the Latino candidate after he leveled him up to replace him in Congress. So he's going to get one of those two posts.
And now he wants a third one. This is great.
Well, he'll get one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he'll continue to accrue pensions, which is the important thing. We need to make sure our wonderful political ruling class leaders are properly taken care of in their dotage. And so Chewy will be, and that makes me happy. By the way, word is that Madigan and most of the Latino caucus in the city council are going to back Chewy, which is an interesting choice for Madigan to make. So the cynical racial politics of the city is part of what we were talking about. We decry it, and then we propagate it. Bizarre to me. Verlon on the south side.
This is the problem when you don't teach assimilation
to people at a young age. And you let schools teach multiculturalism and identity politics. You get the breakdown of this great idea that we call America. Now, this is going to be the testing ground of what you see racial politics all about. You know, just imagine it on a grand scale after you see the shakedown of what happened in this mayor election. I hate, you know what, I feel sorry for Chicago.
Thanks for the call, Verlon. And I'll tell you what, I feel sorry for Chicago and Illinois, and it will be visited on Chicago at some point. I mean, it's in process, but it'll be more pronounced, like when Takeda Pharmaceuticals leaves Lake County, takes 1,000 jobs with it to Boston. That was announced earlier this week.
More homes for sale in Lake County that aren't going to sell.
Right. Deerfield headquarters, that's shutting down. They're pulling out. The company has paid more than $22 million in property taxes since 2008 on its 380,000 square foot tower off of Lake Cook Road and 294 there. Fourth highest property taxpayer in Lake County, after Abbott, Gurney Mills, Vista Medical Center. It cost $63 million to build and a 70-acre site. It got to $15 million in state tax credits to guarantee 500 jobs at the site at the time under Governor Blagojevich. It was the largest tax credit deal granted during his tenure. So $63 million to build 12 years ago. They paid $22 million in property taxes from 08 forward in the last decade. They had a bunch of tax credits. Now they're out. They're gone. And here's the lesson. This is the takeaway from this. Understand the tax credits, the deals, the carve-outs, the way the kleptocracy works. You think that this is the way you resuscitate Illinois. This is the way you make it a business magnet, an entrepreneurial center of activity. Wrong. Wrong. You cannot paper over structural antagonism towards productive risk takers, job creators, investors with one-off deals. Ultimately, the cracks show and they take off. So the tax credits that were provided, it was nice to have those 1,000 people here for a decade and contributing to the community, and now they're gone. And because of this antagonistic environment towards capital formation and job creation in Illinois, what do you think is going to backfill Takeda up there? And you don't think that can happen in Chicago, where they're playing the same game that we've been playing in Illinois? In this, as I said, kleptocracy? That's the lesson. Republicans, Democrats, a ruling class government-centric mentality is destroying Chicago, is destroying in Illinois, and this is just another example. It's a big one, so people take notice, but small ones happen every single day, that the death spiral, economic death spiral, continues to increase in pace. And what's our response to it? We'll find out on November 6th, won't we?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Dan and Amy, before we get to Steve Moran, one more comment about that pharmaceutical giant Takeda pulling out of Deerfield and moving 1,000 jobs from Illinois to Boston. The state senator from up that way, she tried to blame this on Rauner, right? The Takeda got here in 2008.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Julie Morrison is her name, and she...
You've spoken about her before.
Yes, and and it wasn't in glowing terms.
No.
And so let me repeat those less than glowing terms. She is a stone-ass idiot.
Wow.
And for people in Deerfield on the North Shore watching Takeda take 1,000 jobs and probably 1,000 of your friends and neighbors out of here to Boston, take stock of your local elected officials. She is a moron, Julie Morrison. And you actually have a chance to do something different up there. You've had a chance before. with previous candidates, you know, like a pediatrician, Navy helicopter pilot, Ari Friedman. But he didn't cut the mustard for all the geniuses and professionals up in Deerfield in that area. Well, we've got another chance this cycle. There's a Senate candidate, an actual job creator and business person and professional whose IQ, I can assure you, is above room temperature, which makes it double Julie Morrison's at minimum. His name's Barrett Davey. So why don't you, those listening up there watching Takeda pack up all their stuff in banker's boxes, why don't you go knock on your neighbor's door and shake some sense into them? Okay. Had to get that out of my system. Good news nationally, if not locally. The good news nationally comes from the Census Bureau,
yes,
which tells us that crossing the $61,000 per year mark signals the American middle class are finally earning more than it did in 1999 in terms of, in real dollars, stagnant household incomes. We're seeing middle class incomes rise, and importantly, little evidence of rising income inequality. A Gini coefficient, so-called, that measures such, is static. So,
you know who we have to thank for this?
It's not the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. It's the middle-income families getting richer, and that's good news.
Yeah, top 61,000 for the first time ever. We have President Obama to thank for this, right?
I remember that his speech,
yeah,
on Friday at U of I. Yeah, actually, shockingly, by the way, the Associated Press did a fact check of Obama's speech at U of I.
Really? Yeah.
And it was actually accurate, meaning accurately critical of all of the spewage that emanated from the orifice in the middle of Obama's head down in Champaign.
The AP?
I mean, will wonders never cease? Speaking of wonderment, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi, guys. Good morning. I just caught the tail end of that discussion about that company that's moving. Did you say they're moving from the Chicago area to Austin or Boston?
Boston. 1,000 jobs pulled out of Deerfield and going to Boston.
Boston, Massachusetts.
Correct.
Yep.
That's pretty bad. When you're losing jobs to Massachusetts, the alarm bells should probably be going off.
Yeah.
Massachusetts looks good compared to Illinois right now, though.
You're right. The alarm bells should be going off.
When you guys lose jobs to West Virginia and Kentucky.
and population. Yeah, exactly. No question. Well, on the good news front, what about rising income?
You know, it is the story of the year, if not the decade, because, you know, what happened, we used to talk to Trump about this all the time, Larry Kudlow and I, that the big problem with the American economy, and especially this vaunted recovery, remember Trump, you know, Obama kept saying, I started this recovery. Well, for so much of America, there was no recovery. I mean, I used to go on the campaign trail. We'd go to Ohio, we'd go to Pennsylvania, we'd go to Illinois, we'd go to, you know, these states in the Midwest, Iowa, Wisconsin. And I remember we would go to these small towns and I'd ask people, how is the Obama recovery going for you? And you know what people would say?
What recovery?
What recovery are you talking about? Because it was a recovery if you lived in Wall Street, or if you lived in Silicon Valley, or if you lived in, of course, Washington, D.C. But for so many of these other areas, there was no real recovery at all. And so what was happening was that middle-class wages, and by the way, just so you don't think I'm being some kind of partisan here, the stagnation really started under Bush. And so you had stagnant incomes under Bush, and then you had stagnant incomes under Obama. And so it was almost 20 years, Dan and Amy, that the middle-class families had not seen a pay raise, an increase in their take-home pay. And now what we're seeing is some really nice gains. And my buddy Kevin Hassett is the chief economist at the he's the chief economist for the president. He put out a report last week saying, look, if you take into account our tax cut and you take into account that people are getting more benefits and bonuses, and then you take into account the fact that people are working more hours because people are getting more overtime and so on, he found that the average income for families last year went up about 4 or 5%. That's like the biggest gain in in 2 decades. So this is good news, and I'm glad you're reporting it because nobody else seems to want to report this. Finally, the middle class is seeing gains. And I'll say one other thing. The left kept disparaging the Trump tax cut as something that was for the rich. You know, they still say that to this day. The Illinois politicians say it all the time. This was not about the rich. I like rich people. Donald Trump likes rich people. But this was about helping creating a tighter labor market, providing more job opportunities for people in the middle class so they can climb the economic ladder. And, you know, you get a tighter labor market and you get, employees and workers with some bargaining power. And that's exactly what they have right now.
Well, do you think that this trend is going to continue?
I only laugh because, you know, when I'm on CNN, they say, yes, the news is, you know, we have to finally, they finally admitted on CNN the economy is booming. For the first time, you know, they finally admitted that this week. But then, you know, when they say that, they say, but it can't continue. Well, look, I think it can continue. There's no reason we couldn't see this go on for another couple of years, which would be fantastic. Now, what do you think? Okay, here's your economics quiz question today. What do you think today is the biggest constraint on growth in keeping this 3.5 to 4% growth path going?
The fact that Jamie Dimon isn't the president of the United States.
I didn't hear you. What?
The fact that Jamie Dimon isn't the president of the United States.
Yes. Ding, 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 ding. No, it's the fact that there are just not enough workers out there. I mean, we're really seeing the worker shortage now really, starting to have a negative effect on the growth rate because, you know, if businesses can't get the workers here they need, unfortunately, some of those factories may leave the United States and go to, you know, China or India where there are workers. So we need to get all hands on deck. We need to do the work for welfare reforms. We've got to get, you know, young people working off their butts and working and all these things, because that's the biggest problem right now. I talk to employers all over the country. I'll bet a lot of the employers listening to this show are feeling the same constraint. Where are the good workers that I can hire to do all this job?
We went last month to Black Hills, South Dakota, and I cannot believe all of the resorts have all these HB1 visa people here that, you know, and they house them and give them meals because they need workers. They need people to help out. It's amazing. It's a whole other different culture there.
Well, one thing we need, Amy, it's a great point, and a lot of these industries that have shortages, they've been, you know, historically dependent on immigrant workers, and we need more immigrants right now. We need more immigrants who want to come into the country and work. I'm not for illegal immigration, and I'm certainly not for immigrants getting welfare, but I am in favor of letting people who are talented and skilled and motivated come to this country and experience the American dream and contribute to our society. We need that now. We really do, because these businesses, you know, let's take the example in agriculture where, you know, migrant workers have been working in the fields in the United States for the last 100 years. And, you know, let's face it, we're not going to get American workers to do that kind of stuff. So why shouldn't we have more of the agriculture guest workers so that they can come in and earn a good living and then go back to Mexico or Central America, where they come from. So that's another big problem, but it's a good problem to have. That's the point I want to make to you guys. It's a really good thing when you have 6 million more jobs open than workers than when you have 6 million more workers than jobs.
And it's a really good thing to provide some concrete evidence that those crumbs that Nancy Pelosi talks about actually add up into real dollars. So a good little Econ 101 lesson for the kids out there. I wanted to get your take on another matter, Steve. It's been
Before you mention that, can I just say one other quick thing about a comment you made? That you mentioned the Gini index, which you said did it fall or did it stay level?
Yeah, level.
So that is a reversal. This is the irony of the Obama presidency. Every year, except for one of the 8 years that Barack Obama was president, this president was going to return economic fairness and reduce the gap between the rich and poor. Every single year that Barack Obama was president, except for one, the Gini index rose, which means income inequality got wider.
Yeah, there's no question. You mentioned before.
That's what happens when liberals come into office.
And it's happening. There's a laboratory where people can watch these experiments play out in real time. It's called the state of California, the state of Illinois, too. But let's talk about California because it's been a heck of a week out in California. Let's see. We started the week announcing that fossil fuels will be banned there. Then we had the imposition of or legislation moving through Sacramento to impose quotas on the gender composition of corporate boards. Now the California Supreme Court is changing the way independent contractors are classified, such that entrepreneurs, small business owners like barbershops would have to treat people who work a chair and have their own book of business in a barbershop, rent a chair or whatever. They would have to be full-time employees. One Sacramento barbershop owner said, I lost my entire staff. All seven barbers quit after that Supreme Court ruling that changes the way they work. So that you have those examples for the socialists like Kamala Harris, a presidential aspirant, address while other states and the country generally under Trump is moving in a different direction.
So I'm almost afraid that we're having this discussion because Sacramento may give Springfield, Illinois, some really bad ideas.
No kidding.
It seems like these ideas start in California and then they go to Springfield. But you're right. I mean, California has become Looney Tunes. By the way, do you know, this is a little secret, so please don't spread this around. But
sure.
I get my hair cut from the woman who lives next door.
Uh-huh.
She doesn't have a license to cut hair.
Oh goodness!
No, there you go, costing
right. somebody. She should probably go to jail, right?
Yeah, she's gonna have to be on the lam.
And I give her $10. And she's not a professional.
We see that when you're on CNN. We see that she's not a professional.
But the other thing you didn't, I don't think you mentioned in that list of crazy things that are going on the left coast, is that they now have a measure that has passed the state house that would require, by the year 2030, 2035, 100% of all electricity generation from in the state of California has to come from wind and solar power.
Right.
That is insanity. That is crazy. Right now, we get maybe 4 or 5% of our nationally. We get about 4 or 5% of our electric power from wind and solar. They want to go from 5% to 100%.
Good luck with that.
That is
it's a moonshot.
They're going to have solar panel hats. Everyone's going to have their own hat.
Yeah. Like
that's
exactly.
What I was thinking.
They're going to look like Vista Viano.
Yeah. A friend of mine is a fireman. I guess firefighter is the politically correct term.
Yeah, please.
And he was saying, that one of the problems that they are now facing is all of these homes have solar panels on the roof, and oftentimes when you have bad fire, you have to go through the roof, and they can't do it because of the solar panels, so they're making these homes more dangerous. But can you imagine that? I mean, here we have an abundance of natural gas. We have an abundance of coal, more gas and coal than any other country in the world, and we're not going to use it. We're going to put solar panels on every house, and we're going to use windmills, like a 19th-century technology to provide electricity.
Steve.
I mean, that's a very, very – it's laughable, but it's dangerous. I mean, if you want to screw up a state or national economy, screw up with their electric power system.
Yeah, well, Steve, Gray Davis style. Steve, ask not what California can do for you. Ask what you can do for California. This is a moonshot, going from 5 to 100% wind power there. So,
yeah.
That's
By the
exciting.
Way, you mentioned Gray Davis, and I was involved when Schwarzenegger, when they did the recall of Gray Davis and Schwarzenegger became governor because he was so liberal. And you look back at Gray Davis today, he'd be a raging conservative compared to the liberals in Sacramento today. He would.
Yeah, it's frightening. Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Have a great week. Bye.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So you had Mark Zuckerberg before Congress earlier in the year. You had Sheryl Sandberg, COO of Facebook, and Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, before Senate last week testifying as to how social media is or is not prioritizing particular political viewpoints, how it's dealing with those outside interests that are intending or to at least attempt to disrupt elections, the Russian Facebook campaign, Russian bot Twitter accounts and the like. And then this week, we've had some revelations with respect to Google. Google chose not to send Sundar Pichai, their CEO, to testify before Congress. Fox had an email of a Google executive who was discussing how she was trying to use Google's products to increase Latino voter turnout in 2016. And then this video that surfaced that was posted at Breitbart yesterday, Google's entire power structure leadership team hosting a post-election, basically, drum circle cry fest for its employees, the Googleists.
Yeah, that's what they call themselves.
To try and come to terms with what happened, meaning Trump's election. Here's Google co-founder Sergey Brin.
Okay, folks, I know this is probably not the most joyous TGIF we have had. Let's face it, most people here are pretty upset and pretty sad for because of the election. But there's another group, small group that we should also think about who are very excited about the legalization of pot.
And who won the Hawaiian shirt contest?
And then he took Milton Stapler away. That's what happened then. But here's the thing. Google's issues a statement saying we've never exhibited any bias in the products that we produce or the way we use them. James Damore, the former Google engineer fired after writing that memo suggesting quite the opposite, would beg to differ, as frankly would the evidence beg to differ with their statements. All of these senior leaders, including the billionaire founders and billionaire CEO of Google, basically wringing their hands over Trump's election and those who voted for Trump. And frankly, those who don't agree with Google values, whatever those are, some sort of punchline from Silicon Valley. But here's the best part. Larry Page, who's the other co-founder of Google.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter what he says here. Just listen to Larry Page.
Is Google willing to really...
Say too, I'm an alphabet wide. I've been working on fiber a bit, and we definitely have fiber builds going on in a wide variety of places, and those are definitely intensive things. So that's one way we're engaging, I guess.
Oh my God.
Larry Page talking.
Larry Page talking
about structural challenges in today's society.
So I do think we have a lot of structural problems in our democracies, and which I think is really, if you're worried about, the World War III kind of cases. I think a lot of that will be driven by this deep dissatisfaction.
I had no idea that Napoleon Dynamite's brother Kip went on to be a co-founder of Google. Here's Larry Page.
So I do think we have a lot of structural problems in our democracies.
Here's Kip.
Don't be jealous that I've been chatting online with babes all day.
Do it again.
All right, Kip.
I said, come down here and see what happens if you try to hit me.
Larry Page.
So I do think we have a lot of structural problems in our...
Oh, you got it. You nailed it.
Kip.
Besides, we both know I'm training to become a cage fighter.
Say too, Page. I'm an alphabet white. I've been working on fiber a bit.
Yeah, it's the same guy. There's no question. I believe Larry Page also married to LaFonda. Uh-huh. I think they got together after Napoleon Dynamite. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Mike Braun. He's a Republican Senate nominee in Indiana, taking on Joe Donnelly, the incumbent there, one of the Republicans' real good pickup opportunities. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good to be on.
On the serious note, you don't have to chime in on whether Kip is Larry Page and Larry Page is Kip. I won't ask you that. But I will ask you about the Senate hearing last week with social media execs. And some talk on Capitol Hill about looking at consumer protection, antitrust strictures as a way to potentially go after social media giants who aren't comporting with the law in that area. What's your perspective on all this that swirls around social media?
Yeah, well, when it comes to the general idea of anything that is so concentrated among a few or between a few. It's I've always come from the entrepreneurial world where you embrace broad competition, and that generally takes care of things to where you don't even have this issue coming up. So, you know, I don't like the idea that it's so focused, you know, among a few entities. And I think that what's coming to the surface is that a lot of stuff has been going on that most people had no idea was going on. So I think the investigation into it is bona fide. And I would hope that when we're through with it, very seldom do you see the government, you know, weigh in to break up industries. In this case, it was so concentrated from the get-go. I think a lot of bad practices have kind of been, you know, just evolving, and it'll be interesting to see where we come with it. But I don't like the idea that you've got so few controlling so much.
Yeah. Recently, there's been some attacks on political candidates, and it was hit in California. So they had a knife pulled on them. Are you worried at all or concerned about your safety?
Hoosiers are too polite.
You
know, here in Indiana, thankfully, we have not seen much of that. But when you stick your neck out like I have, you know, it's always in the back of your mind. So you have to be eyes wide open and kind of on guard, you know, when you're now in the public arena. I'm hoping that there's less of that over time. But I think, you know, I think Indiana is going to be a place where hopefully you're insulated from it, but it's not to say that you don't think about it. It won't impact how I'm campaigning, and which is I get up early every day, go to bed late, and leave on Monday mornings and get home, if I'm lucky, at 10 to midnight on Saturday. I always like to be home on Sundays. And you're out there exposed. You have trackers, and you've got other folks that you know, are around you all the time that kind of just make you watchful, let's put it that way.
There's, you know, it's said that the midterms are referendums on the incumbent president. So 2018 would be a referendum on Trump to a certain extent. How true is that in Indiana, and how is it impacting your race?
Well, I think it's going to be true everywhere. And here in Indiana, President Trump's approval among conservatives and Republicans is higher now than it was in, you know, 16. Also, I think when you're out there shaking things up like the president has done, main reason I ran, you know, I would not have run for senator had Hillary Clinton been president. I'd be hunkered down in southern Indiana, worried about the future. But it's unleashed among small business, which, you know, I've been that for a long, long time. Over the years, we've grown into a national company. Three of my four kids, you know, work in the business, which is a blessing. But with tax reform and rolling back regulations, you know, that's why we had an over 4% GDP growth in the second quarter. I think we're going to see more and more of that. And it wasn't there. You know, the Obama administration gave us mediocrity. And here, I think we're getting back to, you know, doing things right in a mode of excellence. And you're going to generate a lot of opposition when you're going against something that's been so established and so structured for so many years. When you get a businessman, entrepreneur that comes onto the scene, I think that's exactly what D.C. needed. Here in these midterms, there are three of us that can make it through from the business community. Rick Scott in Florida, Mitt Romney will in Utah. I think we will here. We'll double the business caucus. That's how few people we have in the Senate that have done things in the real world, that are doers, solution makers, conservatives that have lived their lives in the trenches rather than in the career of politics.
Well,
that's what I'm excited about.
Speaking of that, the business acumen and the business experience and success. So President Trump and Vice President Pence, you know, struck that deal with Carrier in the early days of the administration, and much was made about that. How is Trump's trade policy? How is that impacting Indiana businesses, Indiana manufacturing in particular, and what the perspective of that business community is and how Trump is attempting to negotiate new trade deals?
You know, so that has generated concern, and I think mostly because certain businesses that now can only get stuff that's imported due to the fact that a lot of these jobs have left the country. I think that's changing, actually, and we're seeing more of a move back. But in the short run, it does throw certain industries into some confusion. But almost everyone that I've spoken to, and especially farmers that have been hit the hardest with the tariff put on soybeans by the Chinese, know that there's got to be a little short-term pain for long-term gain. This stuff's been embedded in terms of unfair trade practices for decades. And when you've got a guy like President Trump that's not going to accept business as usual, I'm really pleased that the EU came to the table a month ago. Mexico did here a week or two ago, and I think the Canadians are short to follow. And Chinese are going to be the tough customers. And tariffs are the least of what they do. Intellectual property theft, manipulating currency, subsidizing industries, all in their playbook. They're not going to be easier to deal with in 5 to 10 years than they will be now. That's where I think we circle the wagons. But tariffs, if they're not doing what they're supposed to do, especially against the Chinese, you're going to have to find other methods. Tariffs are a short-term tool. Ideally, and President Trump has said it, we get rid of all tariffs in the long run. Mm-hmm. Compete freely and openly like most of us do here in our domestic economy and across the world. He's trying to fix something that's been around for a long time.
Now, Fox News, you must feel good. They released a poll yesterday that say
You
have a lead over Donnelly 45-43, but 8% undecided. How are you going to get that 8% to vote for you?
We're going to keep doing what we're doing. Joe Donnelly is finally going to be held accountable. His main claim to fame is that he's a nice guy that gets along with people. Well, along with that is he's disguised his voting record, disguised himself as a moderate, where every important piece of legislation, from the Iranian deal to Obamacare to funding Planned Parenthood to, and especially voting against tax reform. I love the debate. We've only got two of them lined up. That's all he would agree to. His record is going to be exposed to where Hoosiers are going to know him for what he is. He takes his marching orders from Chuck Schumer and votes on important stuff, you know, with the liberal agenda. That has been flushed out enough. They see a guy like me that is an entrepreneur that signed a term limits pledge, going there for the right reason. It's had a record of accomplishment in the private sector and even in our state legislature, where I authored novel infrastructure legislation. We'll be talking about solutions and doing things, and Joe's going to have the clumsy responsibility of defending a record that matches up with the liberal side of his party.
He is Mike Braun. He's the Republican candidate for United States Senate running against Democrat incumbent Joe Donnelly next door in Indiana. Mike, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. Let's do it again.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so tennis umpires of the world unite against one Serena Williams.
Yeah, they're reportedly considering boycotting her matches after that U.S. Open incident.
Carlos Ramos will never umpire another match of Serena Williams, so she declared.
Well, yeah, they believe the United States Tennis Association sold out Ramos by not defending him against Williams' claims of sexism and insults during that match.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to, their secret, well, I don't even know if it's a secret, but they're forming solidarity with each other to protest her matches.
Well, you know,
maybe
what?
They'll just call in sick or maybe just not show up for work.
Well, good for them for pushing back and not just being you know, virtue signaled to their professional death. Point of order, you know, the actual data, just like historical examples we've provided to give lie to Serena Williams' temper tantrum and those rallying around her. Simps, cowards rallying around her because they want to be virtue signalers too. John McEnroe, the 1990 Australian Open, 1-2-3 forfeit match. That happened. Number one tennis player in the world.
Yeah, he did the same. Smashed his tennis racket.
And was abusive to officials.
Abusive to officials, although he dropped verbally the F-bomb and was swearing, whereas she just called her chair umpire a thief.
It's the same difference. She and demanded for minutes on end that he apologize. It was
absurd.
And then
she brought her baby into it. Well, guess what? We all have children. Well, most of us have children. Or like Dan, you have hypothetical
fictional children.
Hey, are you still going to have that third child?
I'm still considering it.
Okay.
Also, this, the data from tennisabstract.com, a little look-see at data from all matches in the 2010s.
Yeah.
So the last 8 years of matches. All matches, Grand Slam events, finals. Finds that, first of all, penalties assessed are exceedingly rare. And secondly, in all matches, in Grand Slam matches, and in final matches, men were assessed more penalties than women. It doesn't really come as a surprise to me.
No, that doesn't, yeah, but we're a little more refined.
But it gives lie to Serena that somehow men are treated with kid gloves where women are not because there's some sort of institutional sexism in professional tennis. Give me a break. By the way, we've mentioned it, but I'll mention it again just to support the data and to support Carlos Ramos, the umpire. Djokovic was assessed the same penalty for communicating with coaches, his coach that started the whole Serena meltdown. So was her sister, Venus Williams, in 2016. So again, it goes to this idea that, you know, a baseball umpire, you know, different umpires, different referees in basketball call the game a little bit differently. And people get upset when an umpire didn't give Greg Maddux the outside corner. But, you know, with that umpire, you're not going to get the outside corner. With Carlos Ramos's umpire, maybe he's got more of an itchy trigger finger when it comes to communicating with coaches, which is illegal.
And that's what started the whole thing, and then
others do.
And then she had a temper tantrum. Yeah.
So maybe that's his thing, and that's just something you have to factor in. That's part of the game. It's part of the human element of the game, is the referees, football, basketball, tennis, baseball, everywhere.
Volleyball.
So Serena Williams, the evidence just continues to mount against her.
We don't know what we did.
So true.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Coming up October 27th, I believe is the date. We've got a little annual soiree called the Freedom Summit, do we not?
We've got a little shindig going down Saturday, October 27th at the Westin Chicago Northwest and Itasca. This year it's presented by Geiger Wealth Management, Chicago's retirement experts. And this year's keynote speakers include former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who we'll get to. Also, James O'Keefe from Project Veritas, our own Mike Gallagher. Also, Noah Rothman from Commentary Magazine and Kurt Schlichter from townhall.com will be there as well. To get your tickets, and you should get them because this event always sells out, go to freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
All right, and
there's our plug.
We've got November 6th right around the corner. It'll be, you know, with 10 days of our Freedom Summit. But, of course, there's already an eye towards 2020 with all of the Democrat aspirants. You saw them on display during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing, some of them. You've seen them on the campaign trail with their hysterics. You see them running big banks, apparently. Jamie Dimon yesterday throwing his hat into the ring.
These comments came from a J.P. Morgan event. Mr. Dimon, who is always plain spoken and some say very outspoken, was making the comments to a moderator who asked him, Jamie, why don't you throw your hat into the ring, meaning the run for the presidency? Here's what Mr. Dimon said, quote, I think I could beat Trump because I'm as tough as he is. I'm smarter than he is. I cannot beat the liberal side of the Democratic Party, end quote. And then he continued to say, basically, he could punch me all he wants and it wouldn't work. He went on to say, and by the way, this wealthy New Yorker actually earned his money It wasn't a gift from Daddy.
Well, it was a gift from Daddy, Daddy U.S. taxpayer. Not all of it, of course, but Jamie Dimon, of course, and his bank, as well as previous employers, the recipient of federal largesse during difficult times, in addition to the rent-seeking behavior that's conducted by big banks on Wall Street as a matter of daily business. So being lectured by Jamie Dimon is not something I'm particularly want to do, but it is fun because I like these guys like Mark Cuban and Jamie Dimon who think because they're successful in one realm, they could be president of the United States or they can be successful in the political realm. The political graveyard.
Hey, he played. Oh, yeah.
Political graveyard is replete with rich guys who thought because I was successful in business or another sector, entertainment, I will be successful in politics and I can beat somebody electorally. Graveyard is full of people who think that.
Well, Mark Cuban did play the president in Sharknado 3.
That is true.
Just so, I mean, that's where he got a little taste of it.
That's true. Okay. No word on whether Ann Coulter will be his running mate. For more on 2018 and 2020, we're pleased to be joined again by David Clark, former Milwaukee County Sheriff, retired. Now he's a senior advisor to America First Action PAC, which is a pro-Trump super PAC, and he's going to be here in Chicago on October 27th, Itasca to be specific, as Amy mentioned, as part of the lineup for our Freedom Summit. Sheriff Clark, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on with you, Dan and Amy.
So give us your perspective now that you're in the kind of political operative space as an advisor to a PAC. What's your perspective on how the midterms will go and how essentially the referendum on Trump that the midterm represents will go?
Sure. First, a couple of things on what you were just talking about. A lot of people think that they can beat Trump. The problem is nobody has to date. So it looks easy, but it's not. President Trump has just some outstanding instincts. And I'm not talking about political instincts, but he applies it to that. I wouldn't put the two guys that you talked about. I would never use the word great instincts with those two individuals. They're successful in one end, like you say, but that doesn't necessarily transfer over. What a clown show put on by the Democrats at the Kavanaugh hearing. You know, a time-honored tradition of nominating somebody to the Supreme Court, you know, a very important thing under our constitutional process. And people used it, you know, what a buffoon that Cory Booker is to stand up there and or sit up there, I should say, and with his antics. So, you know, going into the midterm elections, you know, I don't really get into making predictions, but it's all going to be about turnout. You know, I remind people, you know, forget about what the pundits are saying, forget about the polls, forget about how many yard signs you see, so on and so forth. We just have to drive turnout, and it has to be in very high numbers. So I'm traveling the country, and I'm looking forward to coming to the Freedom Summit on October 27th. It's one last chance before the November 6th election to rally the base, to energize the base, to help drive turnout. I think that President Trump, the proof is in the pudding. When you ask me about, you know, how he's done leading into the midterms, he might not be on the ballot, but of course his agenda will be. So, you know, we're going to find out if the Trump supporters can rise up once again and push back, beat back this leftist resistance so that what he was elected to do by the Constitution can be carried out.
Are you going into any of the districts where the political candidate is not a supporter of President Trump's, although they're running on the Republican ballot?
No, because they don't show up at the stuff that I'm at. It's not that I don't show up at theirs. They don't show up when I'm there. Really? They know better than that.
I wanted to talk about an issue that we talked to you a lot about when you were Milwaukee County Sheriff, and your expertise is still relevant, particularly for us in Chicago. And that's law enforcement. That was a significant part of President Trump's campaign in 2016. It seems to me in a lot of urban centers like Chicago, but not just Chicago, and with the issue of people in this country illegally who commit acts of violence against other people in this country, that it should still be something that we're attempting to address, the carnage on the streets that is so preventable.
Yeah, without a doubt. But, you know, there's some limitation anyway from the feds This crime and violence is a local issue. Now, what the locals have to do is ask for resources from the federal government to assist them in what is their responsibility. If they do not ask, it's kind of difficult for the feds to come in and kind of take that stuff over. You know, you don't need that kind of fight. Superintendent Eddie Johnson.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but when Rahm Emanuel declares Chicago a Trump-free zone, that's not helpful to law enforcement.
Not at all. You know, like you said, it's been one of the pillars of his campaign to restore order. You know, using the federal resources, you know, when requested to help restore order, but they're resisting. Rahm Emanuel declared Chicago a sanctuary city that relegates all of the residents and citizens of Chicago as second-class citizens. It means something to be a citizen in this country. It means that you get all the rights and privileges of the United States Constitution. And when Emanuel, who thank God is not going to run, but when he extends that to people who are not citizens, then he dilutes the meaning and the intent of citizenship. But as for the crime and violence going on in Chicago, the great city of Chicago, by the way, I think it's really sad, but I have not seen a plan put forth by Superintendent Johnson. I need to see an operational plan to regain control of the streets again. Many of these neighborhoods, and it's not all throughout Chicago, but, you know, if it's in one neighborhood, it's too many for me with the senseless carnage. But
well, their plan,
the criminal element is in control.
Yeah, and their
criminal element
is
in control
contained
in too many neighborhoods.
Yeah, their plan is to keep it contained in those three districts. That's their sense of accomplishment. You know, as long as it doesn't spill over to, you know, homes in the Gold Coast or apartments.
Yeah. Well,
or
the mistake with that approach is violence is like water. It seeks its own level. It spreads. It'll find cracks. It'll find crevices. And the violence will spread. And so it may be, they might think they're containing it in a couple of neighborhoods today on the west side and the south side. But before long, that stuff will spread outside. And it's happened in the city of Milwaukee, where Milwaukee crime is spreading to outlying suburban communities. So that's a failed strategy to think that. And also says, hey, it's okay for the people in these neighborhoods to have to put up with this stuff, for them to get killed, for them to lose their lives, because it isn't all one gang member shooting another gang member. You have kids caught up in the crossfire. You have innocent victims caught up in the crossfire of this stuff. And so for someone to say, well, we're going to keep it contained, it's okay to happen over here, I think that's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, we live in the land of disbelief here in Chicago. As you travel the country, I wonder what you hear from Trump supporters in terms of any concerns they have or something they'd like to see the president do that they think would be most helpful. Is there anything you hear over and over again?
Well, yeah, and, you know, you get into some of these specific instances, like with the Mueller investigation. You know, certain people believe that the president should end it and do that sort of thing. Those are political decisions that have to be well thought out, because there's going to be political fallout. Even though he has the authority to do it, you want to do it wisely. And right now, he's up to his eyeballs in alligators with many of these other things. So, you know, that's something that down the road he obviously will take a look at. But what people are telling me, I mean, first of all, they're loving the fight that he's taken to the left. He's loving the fight that he's brought to, that President Trump has brought to Washington, trying to drain the swamp. It's going to take a long time to do. It's not something that can be done in one election cycle. So I think in terms of, are they satisfied with what he's done thus far? I think very. You look at the accomplishments, you look at the tax cuts, you look at small business growth, you look at a robust economy, wage growth, you look at things like the blue-collar job growth, you look at the unemployment going down, people getting off of food stamps and unemployment rolls and getting back into the job sector. And the proof, like I said, is in the pudding. And that's what people want. That's what they expect out of Washington, D.C., that they weren't getting before Donald Trump got there. They just want results. They want something done. Donald Trump knows how to get stuff done, for heaven's sakes. We haven't had somebody in the White House with that ability in a very long time.
All right. He is former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark. You can catch more of his plain spokenness on October 27th at the Freedom Summit in Itasca, one of our featured speakers. He's a senior advisor to America First Action PAC. And, of course, on October 27th, cowboy hats will be welcome.
Yes.
So, David Clark, thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you on the 27th.
My pleasure. Looking forward to it.
And we should also mention that Sheriff Clark will be signing copies of his book, Cop Under Fire. So if you want, you can get to meet him and he can sign your book.
Cop Under Fire. There you go. All right. Thank you so much, Sheriff Clark. We appreciate it.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
I want you to meet 68-year-old romance novelist Nancy Crampton Brophy. She wrote the novel The Wrong Husband. Are you familiar with that novel?
More of a Danielle Steele guy.
Oh, okay. Well, she wrote this book a while ago, you know, The Wrong Husband. And now she's accused of
killing. Good beach read.
Yeah, good beach read. Now she's accused of killing her husband, 63-year-old Daniel Brophy, who's a chef at the Oregon Culinary Institute, was found shot to death.
At the Oregon or Oregon?
Oregon. Oh. Well, do you say Oregon or Oregon? Oregon.
Well, I don't say Oregon because that's a different kind of culinary institute. So Oregon, I would go with.
The Oregon Culinary Institute was found fatally shot inside his classroom right the day after his death. His wife was so upset, she wrote, "I have sad news to relate. My husband and best friend, Chef Dan Brophy, was killed yesterday morning. I'm struggling to make sense of everything right now. While I appreciate your loving responses, I am overwhelmed." Well, the
did
next
she,
day.
Did she ever follow up with a post? Oh, I made sense of it. I did it.
The next day she was arrested. Police aren't revealing the motive in this case, but she did it. So when your wife writes the novel, The Wrong Husband, you might want to, you know, sleep with one eye open, okay?
I think that's good advice. Fortunately, advice I'll never have to worry about.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.